I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is David Madsen. He grew up in western South Dakota and escaped to the wilds of the Northern Rockies during his late teens. He studied large carnivores for most of his professional life, grizzly bears in Yellowstone and mountain lions in the Southwest, and was an educator at Yale and MIT during a later professional incarnation. After retiring in 2013, he joined his wife, Lisa Wilcox, in advocating for wild lands and wild carnivores. David has been instrumental in keeping grizzly bears protected either through science or advocacy for the last 20 years. And I want to say one more thing, which is there were several environmentalists when I told them that I was going to interview. At the time, it's going to be the two of you, but now it's you. They all wanted me to let you know that you were their heroes and that you were there are among environmentalists people who think that you that the two of you are two of the most important environmentalists around. I just wanted to let you know that.
Well, I run the risk of laughing out loud because I think Louisa would reply as well, along with me, that there are just too many people who have made major contributions to environmental causes for there to be any heroes.
Well, that is a great and humble response. And in any case, thank you for your work and thank you for being on the program. So the first question is, when we think about grizzly bears, normally I think most of us think about Yellowstone or Glacier or someplace fairly far north that is probably a lot of rocks and ice and cold. But grizzly bears once had a larger range. Can you talk about that?
They had a larger range. They actually still do have a large range. Grizzly bears are of the same species as brown bears. So brown bears occupy the full scope of Siberia into Europe. So we still have a lot of Ursus arctus, brown bears, grizzly bears, in the world. But we've lost, the point is that we've lost most of them in the lower 48 states at mid latitudes. Insofar as where they once were, well, we know where they were about the time that Europeans were first encountering them, which was well out onto the Great Plains, but not quite into the deciduous forests in the east. And that's an interesting story in its own right as to why we didn't have grizzlies all the way to the east coast. But what we can document are grizzly bears well out into the plains all the way to the Pacific coast and well down into central Mexico. I have a special place in my heart for the grizzly bears that once ranged out onto the Great Plains because I grew up in western South Dakota. And in fact, on a ranch that where we could still see the tracks that were left by Custer's wagon train when he trespassed on the sacred Black Hills back when they were putatively still Sioux territory. The point of the Custer connection is that he's the first European to have been known to kill a grizzly bear in the Black Hills. And it was only 10 years later, probably, that the last grizzly bears had been killed there. But east of there, well out on the plains, we did have grizzlies, and they were there primarily because of a connection with bison. So part of the point there too is that the diversity of grizzly bear diets varied according to where they lived and where bison was the key food on the plains, salmon the key food on the coast, further south foods like acorns, berries from manzanita were especially important. Also, you had a lot of acorns in the grizzly bear diet over in California, and so on. So the further north you got, the more they meet and dug roots. So widespread, but a pretty dynamic distribution, even so, because we know at one point there were some grizzlies based on fossil remains in the eastern part of the United States. So I don't know if this is a good time to get into sort of my speculations as to why grizzly bears weren't in the eastern part of this country when Europeans first landed, but that's an interesting story in its own right.
Well, I want to get to the main point of this interview about southwestern grizzly bears, but you've mentioned interesting story twice. So yes, please. I mean, you can't just leave us with that.
Okay. Well, I've been intrigued by a whole lot of things when it comes to grizzly bears. How it is, first of all, they managed to make a living energetically. It's still a mystery to me, even after having closely observed them for decades. But the other thing is why they live where they live, why they lived where they lived, and why they didn't live in certain places. And the thing that has always intrigued me about the lack of grizzlies in the east of this country is that we have brown bears, which are the same species, in deciduous forests in Europe. So Romania has some of the highest densities of brown bears anywhere in the world. And if anybody knows about Romania, they have forests that look a lot like what you'd find in the Appalachians. So there's no reason why grizzly bears would starve if they tried to make a living on the East Coast. But the one thing we have in North America that we don't have in Europe, we do have to a certain extent in Asia, is we have another bear species. We have black bears. And it turns out that black bears and grizzly bears evolved more or less independently of each other. And as a result of that, their niche overlaps substantially, which means that they eat many of the same foods. But on the other hand, black bears can climb trees, whereas grizzly bears can't. And as anybody who has lived in the eastern U.S. knows, that a lot of the bear foods are up in the canopy of trees. So oak acorns, beech nuts, you know, on down the line. So it's to your advantage to be a small bear that can climb into the canopies to eat the foods that are in deciduous forests. When you get to Europe, though, you don't have the black bears that are competitors. And so basically, you just have to wait until the beech nuts or whatever fall out of the trees, and then you can eat them off the ground. But there are all those beech nuts left up in the canopy to fall to the ground. So that's probably one reason why we don't have black grizzly bears in the east on the East Coast, whereas we do have brown bears in deciduous forests in Europe. But that also ties into the fact that grizzly bears are relative latecomers to North America, whereas black bears are our native bear species. So they were here in occupying a lot of the best grizzly bear habitat already. It was also good black bear habitat. So they acted as a curb on the expansion of grizzly bears coming from Eurasia down through what's now Canada, down into the western U.S. So that's part of why probably grizzly bears were pretty much always confined to western North America, although there were a few grizzly bears that managed to get into the eastern part of this continent following probably the retreating ice sheets as they melted at the end of the Pleistocene. So that's sort of just a thumbnail of, I think, a lot of the different factors that come into play as to why we have grizzly bears where we did at the time when Europeans first arrived on this continent.
So I'm going to put off the southwestern bears for a moment again, because you said something else very intriguing, which is you said something about how do bears survive energetically. And I am familiar with black bears here, and even with black bears, I am astounded at the number of calories that they eat per day. And can you just sort of amaze us for a moment with the sheer number of calories that grizzly bears need, and also, you know, sort of raise that question that you did about how do grizzly bears survive energetically?
Well, there's, you know, insofar as how much they can eat, that's been documented for a couple different foods. One food, perhaps surprisingly enough, army cutworm moths. It's been estimated that a bear that's feeding most of the day on cutworm moths can consume roughly 40,000 calories, which is a lot.
Typically a human, just for record, typically an adult human male what, might eat 2,000 calories somewhere? Isn't that about right?
Yeah. Unless you're in a hot dog eating a contest or something like that. Yeah. So it's just truly astounding. I don't think there's even the most aggressive human eater could probably not, first of all, physically ingest that many calories, but also just handle it physiologically. So the bears have remarkable adaptations to processing lots and lots of food, lots and lots of calories. Bears that are consuming spawning salmon consume a comparable number of calories during spawning runs, when the fish are most abundant. But that having been said, you can think of those as, army cutworm moths, spawning salmon, as being two hyper-abundant foods that have a high energy concentration. But I think what has astounded me more than anything else comes from having closely observed bears in interior ecosystems where the foods are not nearly as abundant or as rich. And then going around and trying to emulate bears eating what they eat. So, for example, there are certain times of the year when grizzly bears, as well as black bears, typically this is during July and August, will eat a lot of ants and ant larvae. So I've tried to accumulate as many ants as I could on my hand and eat them. I've also looked at energetic analyses of ants and the efficiency with which bears digest ants. And there's just, by my reckoning, there's just no way that a bear could make ends meet eating ants. And yet somehow they do. And the same thing holds for bears digging roots. I don't know how many people have actually gone out and tried to dig up edible roots. I mean, a lot of indigenous people subsisted on roots with the aid of digging sticks or other aids like that. But I've gone around with my, dandelion digger, digging up the same roots in the same, that bears did in the same places they were digging them. And I would have starved. There's just no doubt about it. I would have been dead within probably a week, if that long. So, all I can say is I am still absolutely mystified, even after collecting many, many, many different kinds of foods, running them through the analytic process to find out how many calories were in those foods that were digestible, how much protein, how much fat, how much carbohydrate. I'm still absolutely mystified. I mean, there's some foods like fruits or salmon, some insects, where it makes sense. You can see how they might make a living, or even acorns. But it's not just calories either. It's a nutrient balancing. I think like any human would guess, given that we are like bears, omnivores, you can't live on a diet that's 100% protein. You can't live on a diet that's 100% fat or 100% carbohydrate or whatever it is. You have to balance nutrients. And so even when it comes to berries, berries have a remarkable dearth of protein. So it is amazing that when there's a hyperabundance of berries, bears will eat virtually nothing else, although they'll probably take a deer fawn or an elk, half-grown elk or whatever they can by way of meat when they're eating berries to introduce that protein balance. The point is that bears can somehow manage it physiologically to eat lots and lots of berries for a sustained period of time, despite there not being much in the way of protein. They have to figure it, balance that out somehow in their diet somewhere during the course of the year. And I could go on and on and on. And I guess I just keep going back to this point that I have studied grizzly bears for decades, and I'm still amazed and mystified.
So I have one last question before we go to the Southwest. I know I said that before, but I read somewhere, and I haven't really seen this, but I have read somewhere that bears eat a lot of grass tips. Is that true that they eat grass as well?
They can graze a lot. And
so my question is, without having a ruminant system, how do they digest grass?
By eating a lot of it and passing it through their digestive tract quickly. So what they lack in efficiency, they make up for with volume. And they're highly selective as to what they graze and where they graze it and when they graze it to maximize the digestibility of the vegetal foods, to maximize the protein content of the vegetal foods. So it's not just any grass anywhere, anytime. It's grass that's most succulent when it's first come up, when it has the highest protein content. But it has to be big enough to where they can actually efficiently consume large volumes in a short period of time. But, you know, when you look at the full array of vegetal foods, there's some that they prefer over others. Like they'll take clover anytime over grass for the obvious reasons. I mean, I think most humans, if we were faced with eating grass versus clover, we'd probably eat clover. I mean, the other thing is, not to go on too long about this, but is that there's all these vegetal foods out there that they eat that don't make sense energetically. Again, that don't make sense, like horsetail, which is this fern that grows in joints. I don't know if how many people know what horsetail is, but it's high in silica content, incredibly coarse. It has some detrimental secondary compounds that would be toxic for us. But bears will seek it out and eat it in the spring, probably because it offers them something therapeutic. And so there's a bunch of forbs, I think, that they eat by way of self-doctoring, and other forbs that they don't eat, other herbaceous plants they don't eat because of the secondary compounds, just like we would avoid something that's bitter. So yeah, they actually can graze a lot.
I know I keep putting it off, but I've seen them eat blossoms a lot.
Yeah, and it depends again on what blossoms they are. For example, they will preferentially eat fireweed blossoms. And fireweed is a pretty common herb willow, it's called, I think. Some people know it as herb willow, that grows throughout the northern hemisphere. So they'll eat the blooms on those. And they'll also preferentially consume the blooms on clover. And again, we think about, if we were, you know, looking at a bunch of clover, what we would like to eat, we'd probably be picking the white flowers off of it to eat.
Okay, so let's finally get to the Southwest. And I guess just start with, there used to be bears there, and take it from there.
Yeah. My suspicion is, well, not my suspicion, I guess my considered opinion is, after doing a fair amount of analysis of the foods that were probably eaten by grizzlies, the overall productivity of the landscape, that there were probably at points in time high densities of grizzly bears in the Southwest, but largely confined to the mountainous areas, the highlands, which is where you still have the greatest abundance of bear foods. And there's an incredible richness of bear foods here yet, and as there was through most of the Holocene, which is the period after the melt of the ice sheets about 14,000 years ago. Lots of oaks. For people who live in the Southwest, in Colorado, most people probably know gamble oak, which is one of these oaks that produce acorns that people can even eat with minimal preparation. So that's a staple for bears. There's probably a half a dozen other oak species that produce acorns that are edible. There's a whole raft of different manzanitas, which are shrubs that produce edible berries. And you can just go on down the line. There's pinyon pines that produce pinyon pine seeds. So most people probably have eaten pine seeds, which come from pinyon pines. You get down into Mexico, and there's a whole different array of foods unique to that part of the world that grizzly bears almost certainly ate. So lots of grizzlies, well documented by by Europeans for sure. And the persisting in this part of the world surprisingly late, when it was surprisingly for all sorts of reasons, just in part because Europeans were particularly murderous when, especially Anglo Americans when we arrived. But anyway, so there's a whole story though that probably factors into to why grizzly bears went extinct as quickly as they did, but surprisingly late, like 1931 in New Mexico, 1935 in Arizona, and 1979 in Colorado.
Wow, I grew up in Colorado, and that's in my lifetime. I was born in 1960.
Yeah, yeah, it's amazing that there were still grizzly bears, at least a grizzly bear, wandering around in the San Juan Mountains in the southern part of the state. Which is interesting for a number of reasons, because the assumption had been that grizzly bears had been extirpated in Colorado probably back in the 1950s. And this one bow hunter and his guide encountered an ancient female grizzly bear in the upper reaches of the Navajo River, which is in the southern part of the San Juans, and of course proceeded to kill the bear. But it was definitive proof that there at least had been grizzly bears up through 1979, which is just remarkable that a grizzly or grizzlies could have been in that part of the world and been as cryptic as they were.
You don't need to respond to this at all, but that I was in high school, or either late high school, first year of college. And I actually remember seeing that in the newspaper and saying to a friend of mine, that I would not have a problem with the death penalty for that.
Yeah. Well,
you don't need to take responsibility for my 18-year-old comment, but,
I
do remember it. I remember that.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And, you know, I personally am mortally offended by that whole vignette. I mean, as I've come to understand it, that ended up in the death of that bear. But as much as anything, by the fact that that grizzly is known as the Wiseman Grizzly, so the reason it's called the Wiseman Grizzly is because the guy responsible for killing it was named Ed Wiseman. And begging the question, what claim does he have to the identity of that bear that lived a long and fruitful life, unbeknownst to him, unbeholden to him, despite him and his ilk? So it seems like we can do better credit to these, these survivors than to call them after name them after the person that killed them.
Yeah. So I'm intrigued by, you know, there's like the whole Sky Island area in the Southwest. And I'm intrigued when you said that they lived in the highlands. And, island ecology is sort of interesting. I don't want to get into it too much. But with it being so hot there and bears being so furry and so fat, how would they move through the open desert? And sorry if that's not a good question.
Well, I don't think they very often moved through the open desert. I think they relied on riparian corridors to get from one sky island to another. And that's where just about all of the encounters at lower elevations between Europeans and grizzlies occurred, were in those riparian corridors in southeastern Arizona. So yeah, thermal regulation is a big issue for grizzlies, which is probably why they were never in hardcore Sonoran or Mojave Desert, at least during the Holocene, during the last 14,000 years or so, nor in the deeps of the Chihuahuan Desert. So one different ways they can compensate, and which are is possible given that the distances between the sky islands are not that great, is traveling during the cooler parts of the year, being night active, which is a real common adaptation to high temperatures, or spending a lot of time in the water. So doing probably what you and I would do if we were in the Sonoran Desert and had access to water and were overheating. But all that being said, again, getting back to how adaptable and amazing, remarkable that grizzly bears, aka brown bears, are. You know, when you think that we have brown bears in the Gobi Desert, which can get brutally hot during the summer, so they're capable of living in hot areas. It's just that they have to be highly adapted in terms of their behaviors to take advantage of cooler times, but also have access to water.
So something that we haven't really talked about, there are a couple topics I want to cover. The second one is the possibility of reintroduction. And first, I would like to talk about ecological and political. But before we get there, can we talk about some of the connections between what are the effects of having grizzly bears present versus having them non-present on a biome? And just, you and I were chatting about this before the interview started with, like, there are some surprising connections that when wolves come back into an area, that can affect trout species because the wolves will, without wolves, various herbivores will get lazy and just hang around the riparian zone and destroy it. So wolves chase them around, and therefore you end up with wolves improving trout habitat, which, you know, if you were just going to say out of the middle of nowhere, do wolves improve trout habitat? You'd be like, what are you talking about? Mm-hmm. And I don't know the mechanism of this, but I know it's true that prairie dogs affect rainfall, and they also profoundly affect groundwater. And their burrows are home to, God, I don't know, 60 species, 40 species, 80 species, you know, some huge number of species. And same with gopher tortoises in the Southeast. And so can you talk about some maybe startling or surprising relationships between grizzly bears and other species that we might not think of? Do you see what I'm getting at?
Yeah, I mean, it's what you're speaking to is one of the central tenets of ecology, which is that everything is connected to everything else to one degree or another. And the beauty of grizzly bears, I mean, what I found so exciting about studying them was the fact that they are, bar none, a portal into the world they occupy, a window onto all sorts of amazing kinds of connections that would not necessarily be self-evident, or at least a web of connections that wouldn't necessarily be self-evident. And I think the one that I became acquainted with earliest in my career had to do with the relationship that grizzly bears had with red squirrels, Clark's nutcrackers, white bark pine in the Northern Rockies. So white bark pine produces seeds that are about the size of pinyon pine seeds. And it turned out that a critically important food of grizzly bears in the Northern Rockies, at least in the Yellowstone area, especially the female grizzlies, because the seeds had a high concentration of fat. Fat is an especially important food for females, their reproductive strategy. But as it turned out, because grizzlies don't do a very good job of climbing trees, that they depended on red squirrels to access the pine seeds. So the squirrels would climb up into the trees, harvest the cones, bring them down, make them into these big caches in these traditional sites in the middle of their territories. And the bears would go along, seek out these caches, and exploit all the work that the squirrels had done to get the cones down out of the trees and in the ground. But then it turns out that the main competitor for the grizzly bear is the Clark's nutcracker, a bird that specializes in eating white bark pine seeds. So you might think that having Clark's nutcrackers around is a detriment to grizzly bears, because the more they eat, the less the bears have through the intermediary of the squirrel. But it turns out that nutcrackers are the primary means by which white bark pine regenerates. The nutcrackers harvest the seeds from the white bark pine, they could go around and make these caches of upwards of 40 seeds scattered all over the place. And then they proceed to forget about roughly half of the caches, which means then that they've essentially planted the seeds of white bark pine, which means then you had white bark pine regenerated and regenerating in places it might not otherwise have regenerated. So there's this fascinating connection between the nutcracker, the squirrel, and grizzly bear. And then even more than that, humans got implicated because white bark pine is at a high elevation. It's above about, in the Northern Rockies, above about 8,400 feet. And there's not very many people there. And it's actually, most of these areas are quite remote. So when white bark pine seeds were not abundant because of a failed crop, that meant that grizzly bears spent a lot more time at lower elevations near people, getting into conflict with people. And so during the years when we had a bust in the pine seed crop, we had roughly twice as many grizzly bears dying, being killed by humans. So a real powerful dynamic involving a natural food and a rodent, basically a squirrel, as well, which really then determined indirectly whether we had a grizzly bear population that persisted or not by virtue of how it affected interactions with people.
Wow, thank you for that. And maybe this is off the point, but what did the squirrels get out of this?
It was, I think, a source of outrage and indignation for them. Because I'd be going around following bears and trying to pick up on their sign, and the dead certain way of finding out where the midden was that they had recently exploited was to listen for the outraged shrieking of a squirrel. And so you'd follow your ears to where the squirrel was, and you'd find the squirrel then perched in a tree over its destroyed cone cache. So yeah, but that's a really good question, because I think that the bears affected the persistence of squirrel populations in certain environments, and I think that's also why it was a good thing for the squirrels that you didn't have a good white bark pine seed crop every year, because there were these interludes of 2 to 3 years where the populations of squirrels could recover and they could reproduce. And so you would have then a viable squirrel population that would then provision grizzly bears with pine seeds during a good seed crop.
So years ago, I interviewed interviewed Louisa Wilcox, and she said something that made me personally sad, which was that there used to be bears in California, black grizzly bears, brown bears, whatever you want to call them, in California, and there are none now, and I knew that. And I see black bears all the time, and there are wolves up around Yellowstone, and wolves make their way down here, so there are now wolves in California, and that makes me happy. So I asked her, if humans got out of the way, would grizzly bears do the same thing and just walk down here? And one of the things she said to me, and you know, I'm sorry if I'm getting this wrong and you know misremember after all these years, but one thing she said is that no, because I mean they would eventually get here, but wolves, you know, a wolf can go 1,000 miles to find a new home, but grizzly bears generally expand. And let me know if I completely am misinterpreting what she said. And if so, I apologize. That a lot of times the daughter moves next to where her mother's territory. And so that might expand territory by territory instead of leaping across great territory. So first off, am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So what that means is that it would take grizzly bears a long time to get down here because they'd have to go territory by territory every generation. Is that still correct?
Yeah, centuries, a centuries long process.
Okay, so what this means is without doing some sort of intrusive thing, it would take even longer for bears. Let's just take humans out of the picture altogether. It would take, or industrial humans, it doesn't matter, you know, just let's remove them from the equation somehow. So it would take a long time for grizzly bears to get back down to New Mexico and Arizona. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Not in my lifetime.
And it sounds like hundreds of years at this
hundreds hundreds of years. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, it's, yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Okay. So the next thing I want to introduce is, if we do talk about, I'm getting to a specific point here. The next thing is, if we do talk about reintroducing a species, we all know that when fish and wildlife or fish and game grabs a quote problem bear end quote and takes it out somewhere else, chances are pretty good they die because somebody else already lives there. So reintroduction is fraught with difficulty. But I was interviewing Chris Tompkins several years ago about a program to reintroduce. I love her; she's great. Anyway, to reintroduce giant anteaters to certain parts of South America, and said in that case, it's not a problem at all because it's the other bears who live there who create the problem when they just transport a bear willy-nilly. But with the giant anteaters, there's plenty of great habitat. It's just there aren't any giant anteaters. So they can take a rescued giant anteater who was hit by a truck, put it in, you know, help it recover, and then put it out in this new territory. And it does great because you got great habitat, no competition. So the point I'm getting at is, if we drop off politics and we drop off everything else, is there good habitat? I should have just said this and shut up in the meantime. Is there good habitat that if there was a grizzly bear in Montana that some jerk at the state level is going to shoot because it killed some chickens, instead of shooting it, is there habitat in South America that they could relocate? Would it work on that particular level? Is there good habitat
in South America?
No. In Southwest United States.
Oh, Southwest. Yeah.
Yeah. God, no, I don't want to put grizzly bears in South America.
I was thinking you were creating a really interesting hypothetical, but I think I would have the same response, is that there's no shortage of grizzly bear food in the world, and there's no shortage of rich, productive habitat for grizzlies in the world. I guess one could see that in certain situations as being part of the problem, because human-made agricultural landscapes are actually probably pretty darn good grizzly bear habitat when it comes to foraging, because, you know, basically all the foods that we eat, grizzlies eat. They would be happy to eat our oats and our wheat and our corn and our cows and our chickens and our pigs and just about everything else.
And our trash, but, at the dump.
Yeah, or garbage. whatever detritus we've left behind us that's edible, which is being a little bit trite. But again, it speaks to the, you know, I think it is a fact. There's no shortage of bear food in the world. And even when you look at natural foods, there's ample natural foods for grizzly bears in the Southwest, in Colorado, in California, Oregon, Washington, you name it, well on down into Mexico. All the places, you know, where grizzly bears once lived, there's still lots of food. So the two big obstacles are, you know, as you were describing, the logistics of bears getting to these, you know, rich habitats on their own through a natural dispersal process, which is agonizingly slow. And the other is, more than anything else, human tolerance. You know, the way I put it is, what goes on between people's ears, the stories we tell ourselves, about our relationships with nature, about our relationships with bears, that more than anything else is going to determine whether grizzlies or any other large threatening animal can survive in any particular area. I mean, just
go ahead, please.
Yeah, but just to emphasize the importance of that, I mean, a simple concept that I try to put out there for people to think about is that it doesn't take very many lethal people before you're not going to have grizzly bears. So in other words, it only takes a handful of people with large caliber firearms willing to kill any bear they see, and that before we won't have any grizzly bears. And you can think of places like that probably where you have people like that. On the other hand, you have places like national parks that are inundated, albeit by people on, you know, confined to roadways for the most part, but inundated by millions of people, where you have thousands and thousands and thousands of encounters between people and grizzly bears. And the grizzly bears survive just fine. And that's because people are there by and large to celebrate grizzlies. They don't have guns. So you can have a high level of interactions between grizzly bears and people, and grizzly bears can survive. And it really depends on, again, on how we behave, which is driven in turns by, you know, the attitudes we bring with us.
There's something I want to address that has to do with, thank you for all that. And that I know black bears, I literally in the summer may see 6 or 7 or 8 bears in a day. And last summer, I was very both sad and honored when there was a mother who evidently decided she didn't want her twins because she left them in a tree outside my house. And I was honored she chose here. So the point is that I see bears a lot, and people go, oh my God, aren't you scared of them? And I always point out there's only one human dies every 2 years in North America because of a black bear attack. And that, you know, they're huge animals, and they can kill us, but they don't really want to. We're not, and I'm not suggesting that people be cavalier about grizzly bears, but are they as scary as the Sports Illustrated article from, I think it was, you know, back in the late 60s. I read this when I was a kid and it terrified me. Night of the Grizzly. Do you remember that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And are they as scary as that, or are they just these huge animals who for the most part want to be left alone? Or, and I don't really believe this, are they cuddly teddy bears that you should go up and pet?
Well, I think one way into that question is to just simply look at the data where there has been record of the outcome of an encounter between a grizzly bear and a human. And here I'm going to be talking about grizzly bears that live in interior North America, and which are behaviorally different than the brown bears that live along the coast. And I can get into why that would be. But in over 90% of the encounters, the bear runs away. If it has any option at all, it will run away. There might be a certain percentage where it stays in place, doesn't move, typically because it's bedded down and might feel secure despite the fact that the person is close. And there's only a very small percentage, you know, less than 1%, well less than 1%, like 1/100 of 1% of all encounters that involve the bear attacking the person. I mean, there's certain circumstances that increase the odds that the bear will attack, and that's if it perceives there to be food at stake, either food that's in the possession of the person or food that the bear perceives to be its food, and where the human is intruding upon it and threatening its access to what it considers to be a prized resource. So just by the statistics, you know, aside from how many people are killed or injured by bears throughout North America, if you just crank it down to, let's say we have an encounter, what's the outcome going to be? It's going to be the bear doing the judicious, safe thing by its reckoning and getting away as quickly as it can. and I, you know, speaking from my own lived experience, what's going to determine the outcome of an encounter more than anything else? Well, first of all, we depend upon the kindness of the bear And almost invariably, they will be kind in the sense that they won't attack. They will just want to leave. But also, it really the outcome depends on what we bring to that encounter. If we are terrified, and I have different ways to describe the wrong way to be when you encounter a bear, which is when if you are outside of yourself, if you're out of the top of your head, which is a manifestation of anxiety and fear, the animal's going to pick up on that. And not only are they going to respond differently because they perceive that fear and that anxiety, but we will more likely do something that's stupid that will elicit maybe something aggressive on the part of the bear. So we can count on the bear over 99% of the time to not be a problem for us. And we can increase the odds of a favorable outcome by bringing a positive or calm attitude with us to an encounter. I mean, the other thing that we can do as humans is just be aware enough not to enter into a situation that is likely to be problematic in the first place. Like if we know a bear is there, don't intrude on its space. Don't be rude. Be aware of good bear habitat, the areas where bears are likely going to be. So we're that much more attentive. Be aware of things like the sound of ravens, the sound of flies, both of which can signify a carcass, which means we might run into a bear that's going to protect a prized food in the form of carrion. So there's a lot of different things that in the mix in terms of how bears will respond to us. I think, you know, I've left just about all of my encounters with grizzlies with a sense of awe of having connected with something powerful and intelligent. And those moments where I've actually looked in a bear's eyes to see something behind those eyes, something that I could relate to. Yeah, it's magical stuff.
Thank you so much for that. And the reason that we have about 5 or 6 minutes left. And the reason that I wanted to go that direction was because for two reasons. One is I interviewed this guy from India several years ago about he loves king cobras and does a lot of work to keep people from getting bitten by king cobras. And king cobras kill, I think it's like 70,000 people a year. It's a lot. And I said, do you have a problem with people hating king cobras? He said, no. My problem is mainly I just have to get people to wear rubber boots when they go into king cobra territory. They love the snakes. And we contrasted that with the hatred of wolves, the hatred of coyotes that pervades the American West and hatred of grizzly bears. So my point is I just wanted to, I mean, for crying out loud, they kill like 70,000 people a year and they still love the snakes. It's just there are technical things. He did not have to deal with an underlying dislike and an underlying overwhelming fear. Just it was purely technical. Okay, so having gotten that out of the way, you know, given that the bears won't come back on their own, would you have a problem with what? Sorry, that's one of my dogs barking. Would you have a problem with attempts to reintroduce grizzlies to the Southwest?
No, not at all. I mean, I think there are always people who will take exception to having an animal like a grizzly bear in their backyard. And they are real consideration when it comes to, you know, thinking about planning to bring something like a grizzly bear back. You somehow have to deal with the people who harbor a great deal of antipathy towards grizzly bears. But the beauty of people is that we are fungible. Over the long haul, we've become much more environmentally friendly, much more benevolent when it comes to animals like wolves and grizzly bears. And that's as writ large as a general proposition. So that's the long-term trend. That's really promising. Education can do us a certain amount. Outreach, just acknowledging people's concerns, can do a certain amount. There's always going to be the people who are intolerant and also disregarding of civic virtue, if you will, that they don't care what's good for the collective of humanity. They are just resentful and antagonistic towards anything that seems to be getting in their way. And oftentimes the way we deal with people like that is to, you know, I think legitimately treat them as criminals or potential criminals. So there's always a place for law enforcement, always a place for law enforcement for certain people that are beyond the pale. And I mean, that may be controversial, but I think if you are considering bringing animals back, you need to do a lot of outreach, you need to do a lot of education, but you also need to do law enforcement so that you can execute something that's probably going to be controversial in certain communities. But along the lines, too, of how important attitudes are, both individually and collectively, I like to bring up the example of Romania. I mentioned Romania earlier. It's got probably 8,000 brown bears, same species as the grizzly bear, living essentially, if you can imagine there being 8,000 grizzly bears in Appalachia with that kind of human density. That's what they have in Romania. That's possible. That is potential. But it really comes down to a whole evolved way of living with grizzlies, which is about certain narratives that are community narratives as well as individual narratives that really create sort of a more gracious space for something like a grizzly bear. That's possible.
Aren't there bears in Italy?
There are bears in Italy. Yeah, in the Apennine Mountains, in the central part of Italy, just east of Rome. Not very many, and they subsist largely on human-related foods, but they've survived. It's amazing. It's remarkable.
So, okay, so two questions left. And I'll tell you both, and then you can just answer them both in the next couple of minutes. One of them is, how do we make this happen? And two, sorry if this is going to be too hard and too complex, but two is, let's pretend that grizzlies were back in the Southwest. What cascading positive ecological effects would you foresee from that just off the top of your head? And we did not even get to talk about hyperphagia. Sorry.
Oh, that's all right. The Fish and Wildlife Service has an obligation under the Endangered Species Act to assess potential habitat for grizzlies in their former distribution and their former range. They have not done that yet for the Southwest. They have an obligation to do that. So unfortunately, it often requires litigation to get the Fish and Wildlife Service to fulfill its duties. So that's one way to approach getting the ball rolling. The other thing is to do what's being done in California right now by a group of researchers out of Santa Barbara, that they're basically gathering a lot of intelligence about people's attitudes regarding the reintroduction of grizzlies, about the distribution of suitable habitat, a lot of the work that I did in the Southwest. So they're laying the groundwork, and that also needs to be done. It needs to be done starting now if a person's going to be thinking seriously about a reintroduction effort, even, you know, 10 years, 20 years in the future. So there, you know, it's actually fairly a complicated process to get the ball rolling, but there are levers, there are things that can be done. In terms of the benefits of having grizzly bears on the ground, ecological ramifications, there's manifold effects that any animal like a grizzly bear will have. It's you know, it's hard to foresee what they all might be. But one thing, for example, that's been documented in the Northern Rockies is grizzly bears being gardeners, which is to say they go to these specific locations, they till the soil to get at roots, but by virtue of tilling the soil, they not only propagate the roots, but they also increase the nitrogen content. So they're enriching the soil at the same time. So that's just an example at a very, very small scale. And I think in terms of the effects they might have, I guess where I would go is a willingness to be surprised. Because a lot of what I've learned about grizzlies, I've been surprised by stuff I never could have anticipated, stuff I could never have imagined. Which is great because I love being surprised by the complexity of the world, the natural world. I love being surprised by grizzly bears, just going around and seeing what next it is they're doing that I didn't know they did. So humility and surprise are probably what's warranted if we're thinking about bringing grizzly bears back in terms of what we might find.
So that would be a wonderful place to end, but I've got another thing I thought of, which is when I think of bears, one of the first things I think of is moving nutrients around, like eating salmon at a stream and then pooping it 500 yards into the forest or dragging carcasses around. And also, I have never gotten out of my mind something I saw many, many years ago, which was a big pile of bear poop with grass seeds growing out of it. So what the bears had done was they moved the seeds around. So in addition to everything else, just removing nutrients, they're also, you know, planting stuff wherever they go.
Yeah. It's been well documented that grizzly bears are good dispersers of seed. With the preparation of their gut, enhancing the germination of whatever seeds pass through it. And thinking about that too, this is getting off on a tangent, and I probably shouldn't go here, but it's been pretty well documented, I think, to the extent that this kind of stuff can be documented, that giant ground sloths were the primary disperser of Joshua tree seeds. And that one of the reasons why Joshua trees probably won't do well in the face of a changing climate is because we don't have giant ground sloths anymore to transport the seeds, several kilometers away from where Joshua tree currently lives. So again, who knows what these animals might do for an ecosystem? And, I would love to find out what grizzly bears do and how they make a living and the effects they have down here.
Well, thank you so much for all that. And thank you for your great work in the world. And thank you for being on the program. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been David Mattson. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.